Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations. This is episode 11 on high reliability organizations, and the object of our discussion today is a 1995 paper from Journal of Management by Beerley and Spender entitled Culture and High Reliability Organizations, the Case of the Nuclear Submarine. To get a link to the text, or to read a freely available overview of the concept, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This episode is brought to you by the Innovation, Knowledge and Organizational Networks Research Center at the University of Warwick, whom we thank for their continued support. My name is Dimitris, coming to you from the University of Warwick campus in the United Kingdom.
And this is Pedro, coming to you from New York City.
This is Dr. Ralph Soule coming to you from Chesapeake, Virginia, at the mouth of the mighty Chesapeake Bay.
We have a doctor in the room.
We do. In fact, I graduate from the George Washington University in official ceremonies this week, so I'm very much looking forward to that.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's fantastic. Yes, congratulations.
Yeah, so I'd like to give a brief introduction to the article, and as part of doing that, I think it's important to talk about What are high reliability organizations, or what is high reliability organizing? And the term high reliability organizations came out of research that was done by University of Berkeley and University of Michigan scholars in the 1980s that was informed by nuclear aircraft carrier flight deck operations and electric power plant, nuclear and non-nuclear operations, trying to understand why certain organizations have safety records that are far superior to others, and the practices, trying to explain the practices that they use to achieve these highly effective outcomes. There are many definitions of high reliability organizing, but I'm going to give one of my favorites, and that is that high reliability organizations work in situations that have the potential for large-scale risk and harm, but manage to balance effectiveness, efficiency, and safety to produce consistently safe operations. There's a misconception among some people that you can only be high reliability organizing if you're in the government or you don't care about the profit motive, and there's many companies for profit that execute the principles quite well. So I don't believe that's a limiting factor. The other thing that highly reliable organizations do is manage errors through teamwork, accountability, transparency, and constant improvement. The high reliability organizing principles that we're going to be discussing in the Beerley and Spender article and the scholarship associated with them provide a coherent approach to supporting safety management and education that go beyond mere compliance with regulations and punishment for not following the rules. In the case of the Beerley and Spender article, that you could consider it something of a refutation of Charles Perrow's thesis that society has become too advanced for our administrative systems and the danger of catastrophe in certain kinds of highly technological organizations, such as nuclear power plants and certain kinds of high-risk chemical processing, are such that accidents are inevitable. And this is the thesis of Perrow's book, Normal Accidents. And there's a whole theory of organizational and risk behavior called normal accident theory, which basically says accidents in highly complex, tightly coupled systems where the individual parts of the systems interact very quickly and in unexpected ways are such that those technologies should be completely abandoned because the technologies are expected, or what Perrow called normal, for those kinds of industries and activities. And I don't want to get into details at the moment, but Beerley and Spender argue that there's more to the story because organizational culture plays a big role in creating highly reliable organizing and organizations. And they use the particular case of a nuclear submarine. They were apparently nuclear qualified officers in the Navy upon graduation from undergraduate school. And they describe the particular characteristics of a Los Angeles-class submarine and the crew and the way it performs as a means of describing how high reliability organizing can take place.
Yeah, I know we're not going into Pero that much, but I think it's important to note that he's, as you mentioned, is kind of where this whole movement emerged from, because the work that you alluded to, he basically says that accidents, I think, are inevitable, that they're unavoidable, and precisely because of the intertwinement of complex technology with people, that they can also be unpredictable. So he was a bit of a Luddite in that way, suggesting that more complex technology should really be abandoned, because I think that's a quote saying that our technological advancement has outgrown our administrative capacity, or something to that effect.
Yes.
So it's a very interesting, very insightful, albeit a bit pessimistic, perspective on the advancement and interaction of technology with people, in that as long as you lose grasp of the basic processes, or maybe because of the speed of the processes that are going on together, then the risk, according to Pero, is inevitable. And it is taking that people from the high reliability movement, what would later become known as that, but primarily Wyke, Roberts, these guys, then a whole bunch of other people that we'll probably go through in the duration of this episode, they said, no, well, technology is complex and it's great, but accidents can be avoided, and they are avoided routinely in these really large organizations. I think one of the catalysts for that was that Pero's theory wasn't supported by statistical facts. So the organizations that he classified as high risk, such as nuclear weapon platforms and power stations and some chemical processing, they had far fewer accidents than low-risk organizations such as generic manufacturing, for instance, or construction and such. So that's kind of the context of where this school of thought is coming from. And I think it's important that we mention these things, since just going around talking to my colleagues about this episode that we were going to do, I realized that very few of them are familiar with what this high reliability organizing is.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me, because it's a kind of narrow focus in organizational theory. But I would argue, having worked in organizations practicing high reliability, it's very important to public safety and improving safety performance.
Just to add to that, I think there is also generally, you know, the interest in more traditional organizational field. And I think that high reliability organizations bring to the picture general discussions on form of structure, which are themes that, you know, are not so popular nowadays. At least that's my view, because I'm very interested in that, and has to do with my general interest in bureaucracy and form of structures and organizational structures that are interacting with human action. But I just feel that people are not so keen on those issues nowadays.
I think it may be a PR issue more than anything, because going through this paper, a few of the concepts that we looked at in our previous episodes came up, namely Taylorism and Mayoism, or the Hawthorne studies. And much of this does seem conceptually familiar to, as you said, various forms of bureaucracy and post-bureaucracy. So I enjoyed reading this immensely.
Yeah, so one of the things I think we should talk about as we ease into the paper is the authors actually give some good definitions or descriptions of what high-risk systems are, right? Because we gave some examples. They actually talk about the features of high-risk systems. So I'd like to go through those just briefly. One, they say that they have the potential to create catastrophe, which could be expressed in terms of loss of life or widespread environmental damage. The second characteristic is complexity. They have large numbers of highly interdependent subsystems, with many possible combinations which are nonlinear and poorly understood. And I mentioned that briefly in the introduction. And then they are tightly coupled, which means that perturbations are transmitted rapidly between the subsystems with little attenuation and often in ways that are opaque to the operators. And Pero formed his ideas. I'm not going to spend this whole article deconstructing Pero, but he did form many of his ideas about normal accident theory based on the study of Three Mile Island in the United States, which was a nuclear reactor meltdown that happened in the late 70s, as I recall, or could have been early 80s. But the point was, at many point times during the accident sequence, the operators were absolutely confused about what was going on and did not understand how to respond. And in fact, actually turned off many of the safety systems that were trying to function to protect the fuel from meltdown. And I've read the accident description in studies many times. And at one point, they had a alarm logger that was supposed to help the operators keep track of alarms that were going off so that they didn't have to write it down in their logbook all the time. At one point, the alarm logger was some 2 hours, 2.5 hours behind all the alarms that were going off. It was unable to keep up. And the operators were dealing with something like over 1,000 alarming signals. So it actually just became overwhelming for them.
I think contributing to your example of the Three Mile Island, I think the definition that Birley and Spender end up on is Wyke's definition from 1987, that high reliability organizations are those which choose to place reliability above profit. And I don't know much about the Three Mile Island situation or how things like profit even fit in there, but the entire notion of why organizations may fail or may be reliable may have to do with it's just different. It's you're injecting the market concerns and individual motivations and fallibility and all that kind of stuff that we talked about, I think, quite a lot in the Bernard episode, why people may or may not want to collaborate or cooperate or even follow certain rules. Also, it's kind of unlike Pero, who seemed to have had his main concern with technology, that it's just getting too complex. These guys and Wyke and kind of where the field, I think, I sense is heading, they more emphasize human agency. I remember someone saying way back, a friend of mine, that technology doesn't err, it's humans who do. So, you know, technology doesn't mistake, it's the operators and the people involved with it who make mistakes.
I think it's perhaps a good point here to add how is the authors, what they're trying to, what are the frame they're trying to use, you know, to add to Pero and, you know, like refute some of their ideas. And from what I understand, they start exactly the paper by put up some concepts, especially the idea of culture and organizational learning, which I understand that they propose that is the missing gap, in a way, Pero's account, and exactly what allows them to account for what you're referring to, Dimitri, which is human agency and how human systems, you know, can also become very complex in a way to keep pace what is happening with the technology.
Right. So maybe shall we go through all of them? Because there's three components. One is determining whether it's high risk or high reliability, which is, I think, what we mainly covered now, which is the difference between saying that accidents are inevitable and we're all gonna die unless we, you know, abandon technology we cannot directly intervene with. Then second part is failure. And then the final bit before they go into describing the submarine is on organizational learning. I don't think we should spend too much time on failure since we kind of covered that as well, but I think noteworthy is that this is where Taylorism comes up, especially if we think about the differences in perspectives that you just mentioned, Pedro, is that the idea that failure is inevitable because of complexity of technology is at the same time read as an idea that failure is inevitable because people do not understand technology as well, or they're not as knowledgeable. And there's a lot of Taylorist elements in that the operators, the majority of laborers, majority of the employment pool, they are simply maybe not capable, well, certainly in operational terms, to comprehend the whole big picture of, you know, a nuclear reactor or a electricity distribution infrastructure or something like that. And because of that, as in the Ralph's Three Mile Island example, they just they get overwhelmed and make mistakes and accidents happen. Because of that, the whole system of problem solving and problem identification, it's the idea there is to centralize it around the core of highly knowledgeable engineers or other professionals, and then issue instructions and, you know, this whole top-down, you know, if A mm-hmm. happens, do B. Whereas on the other hand, what we're going for today and what this paper is about is the exact opposite of that. It's more about completely breaking this down and investing trust and efforts and knowledge into individual system components. I've been reading this paper for too much, but individual people within the organization.
Yeah, and I think that's key, is that Perro argued you have to have the centralization because of to prevent failure because of what Dimitri said, but also Perro noted that decentralization is important because you in complex systems you want to put the decision making down to the people local on the site because you can't anticipate every kind of problem, and that's where Taylor said you can't just Perro you know, perhaps a Taylor acolyte, but maybe that's too strong a statement, but Perro said you can't reconcile that paradox that centralization is needed for the complexity, but decentralization, which is a way to prevent failure, overwhelms the operator with too much information. You can't make decisions in those circumstances, and that's really what the Beerle and Spender article is trying to argue, is that Perro reached a dead end as far as they were concerned in organizational theory because he didn't consider other forms of the organization that we're going to talk about shortly.
I think that we can all boil down that a bit, the whole idea of, you know, worker empowerment in a way. So delegating some certain tasks to the workers. And what is interesting to me here, and reflects a bit what I was observing in the complex product development company I was studying for the PhD, is that it's possible to almost divide up what you can centralize and what you can decentralize, because, you know, when it goes to the operational technical things that can be in the hands of the workers, it's quite easy in a way to put it there if you're willing to do so. But you can also centralize the more, I would say, high level, strategic, or exceptional to the rule kind of situations. I just want to say that I saw it happening, so it's, you know, it goes in a different kind of setting than a high reliability organization. So,
well, no, I think that's a good point.
Although I don't like some of the ideas of culture that they lay out, but I think what's interesting here is that they quickly couple culture with learning, and it's, you know, I like this view of culture as less this united, unified, stable thing, and they're trying to put emphasis on more how do things come to be, you know, how people are socialized into that, how do they learn and relearn, you know, what in a way is the normative aspects of the word they inhabit, which then kind of like operationalize culture in an interesting way.
Yeah, and the way they tie it to organizational learning, you know, after they defined as the, you know, body of shared knowledge, you know, built up through learning, they say that, and this is an important point for higher liability organizations, a lot of learning in life is trial and error, but that's not feasible in high-risk organizations because the consequences of the errors are too great, and the complexity of the system makes it very hard to interpret the results. That's one of the big problems you have in big organizations, is there's this big time lag between the time you do something and some output of something changes, and there's lots of other interactions, and it may not be just the thing you change, which makes trial and error learning, or learning in general, very difficult in complex organizations.
they situate themselves in these two versions of culture. One is what we're familiar with from early management studies, which is that culture is just this national thing. And if you recall in episode one, we talked about how Taylor was perplexed. How is it that his employees can be motivated playing cricket or something, but display extreme laziness in the workplace? So you have that level of culture that it's external to the workplace. And on the other hand, there is Mayo and Hawthorne studies that culture is within organizations, at least the culture that matters towards understanding work and employment. And it's developed on interpersonal group level. And as you said, they suggest something different, something I think that's more commonplace nowadays, that it's more of a sort of a collective process of figuring things out, if anything. And the way you do that is basically culture.
Yeah. And the last thing I want to say is that what is particularly interesting is usually some discussions on culture that, well, we all know that culture is built on the socialization of newcomers, otherwise there'd be no culture if you don't perpetuate that and you continue to reinforce that. But many descriptions of what organizational culture is tend to gloss over how the socialization happened. And I like what we're going to get later, but you know, they go exactly to the specific mechanism of how the hiring happens, what kind of training do these people get, what kind of stories circulate this environment, which are always to perpetuate in a way, to use the famous term, engineer this culture. You know, so I appreciate that they are like making it very concrete.
Right. So I think it's good to talk about what the authors identify as the fundamental difference between Perrow and Wyke when they're talking about these notions of culture and this presence or absence of high level collective knowledge and how people in the organization function. For Perrow, all the knowledge was scientific, and that was all built into the control and the structure and the centralization and the specific roles people had to be in. And he basically didn't look at the people in the system. He looked at the system. And so he argued that since you can't have infinitely effective knowledge or the knowledge that was necessary to operate the system, that conflicts with the delegated power, like as Pedro was talking about, the empowerment you need to give individuals. And then there where there is no way to deal with the faulty knowledge that the people who are the centralizers, you know, the people who design the system have. And that's why that technology is unreliable. Whereas Wyke and the other authors that the Beerlein Spender quote, Wilkins and Uchi, you know, that for them, scientific knowledge is combining or coexists with higher level collective or social knowledge. And Pedro, you mentioned that earlier, as part of its culture and part of this, that social knowledge that people have, and that you can balance the two, that centralization and decentralization. And that's done through culture and social practices. And that's how you can have a high risk organization, but that can be highly reliable. That's the sort of the key difference that the authors point out between Wyke and Perrow.
I think it is key indeed, especially because it highlights something very important through this notion of knowledge. So we have a difference between knowledge as information, essentially, or characteristics, rules, basically objectified stuff. And on the other hand, we have knowledge as a sense. Here on page 644, they're quoting Wyke, saying that the sense is stored as knowledge in the retention process. So it's far more corporeal and embodied in an individual or a group of individuals. And I think the nuanced yet key kind of a nugget there is that high reliability organizations are not about getting the best available information or the largest amount of information out there. It's more about dealing with ambiguity of the information that you have. So when we looked at in episode 4 on organizational routines, and then again in episode 6 on Weber, all those guys, they were looking to kind of restrict uncertainty through manipulating organizational structures and such things. Here, on the other hand, uncertainty is fine. It's accepted as a fact of life, and there are no illusions about getting perfect or close to perfect or complete in any sense information. As you coming back to the Three Mile Island example, you know, it just can be too much. It can be temporarily dislodged. You know, it's just it's too unrealistic to expect any kind of completeness when it comes to unfolding of real-time situations. So what they're more pressing on in this way of sense is teaching and learning how to deal with ambiguity. That it's not that information comes in and it tells you exactly what is happening. So this is a problem now, and then you go, okay, so I have a solution here, where's my 10,000 page manual? It's more about, you know, a light starts flashing and you need to figure out why and what, and that's where the whole I think familiarity with the broader system and how it all is interconnected and works together comes in. So the distinction between Pero and Wyke and others that they're building on, I think that's kind of one of the key places where one would begin understanding what is this high reliability management and why it's so highly reliable.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
And I'm pleased that you do, because you have experience with that.
Sure. Well, we'll get into that. And I think that when you were talking about this, you know, the uncertainty versus organizations, you know, you didn't quite say it, but it's kind of implied that there's this thinking out there. I inferred that there are people who believe, oh yeah, well, if we get rid of nuclear power plants, we won't have to deal with organizations that have to deal with uncertainty. And that is a factor in all organizations. There's always some level of ambiguity and uncertainty when you get above a employee level of one. And so that's not, like you said, Wyke and others don't consider that abnormal. They consider that fine, because there's ways the organization can manage it. Right. So the next section, they talk about the submariner's culture. And in fact, that's for anybody, the listeners out there, that's the way you say it, is submariner. They don't like to be called submariner, even though the mariner word, you know, it gets pronounced mariner, but the submariners, they decide to change the way it gets pronounced because they don't want to consider themselves submariners. So that's important cultural note there. So one just general observation I have about the paper is the authors describe it as an ethnography. And they give Rosen's description of ethnography. And I scratch my head a little bit about that, because I'm thinking, all right, so an ethnography with two people in your sample size or your participant group, that's a bit on the thin side for an ethnography. And I'll talk a little bit later about one of the things that I think is interesting that you see regularly in the service, but it's common to other professions as well. People who come into the profession, and so let's use doctoral scholars, right? So you get a PhD or EDD in my case, and you're, you know, let loose into the community, and there's a pretty big difference in how you understand the community and the things that are important, like getting published and working with your colleagues and going to conferences, which actually came up in our interview last week at the Organizational Learning and Knowledge and Capabilities Conference. There's a difference there. And if somebody, my experience is, if somebody comes into an organization or profession and only stays for a brief time and then moves on, their understanding of the organization is frozen at that level where they had the experience. And so I think that applies to Brilliant Spender. They came in as junior officers on nuclear submarines, and I don't know if they're on the same submarine or different ones, but that's not material. A lot of what they have, the paper is very good. I'm not criticizing the paper per se. There's things I observations I'll make later, but they have many places they have a junior officer's understanding of the Navy and high reliability. And so I'll try to fill in later as we go some of the things I think they left out or could have done a little bit better on. And, you know, they had to make choices about how much to put in the paper, but I think I can add a few more things based on my different level of experience in the community.
Can I just say something towards that? Because one of the things that I felt very strongly, I do like the paper as well, like you, Rolf, but it just sounded weird to read it to me in a way, because it doesn't read as a typical paper, because they never really present how they get the data and what's their position, who they are, and how the things happen. And I think that in a way, my problem is not so much that it is a specific view, because of course all views are a view from somewhere, including like any. So when you go into an ethnography, so you always have like someone's position, even though you might not be aware of. But the problem is that they never make that explicit. So I, for one, didn't even think that they had this no junior view, but I could sense that, you know, they are describing it somewhere, but they pretend they have like the final truth of everything that is happening, you know. But since they don't account for it, it's hard to know exactly tease it out. What we missed.
That's a great point. That's a great point. They weren't explicit about that. So I think you made my point way better than I did, Pedro. Good job.
Okay. Also, this doesn't qualify as an ethnography. It's maybe something like a phenomenology, even author ethnography at best. Because when I read ethnography, I thought, okay, so you're gonna go and go there with them, which I thought was an excellent level of access that mm-hmm. you got granted. But then it just turns out that it's as Ralph pointed out, them just piecing together their service experiences, which, you know, is fine, but that's not an ethnography. I got all excited there, thinking like, wow, this is going to be really cool.
Right, and it's not a good phenomenology paper either, because they're not really describing what it means to them. They're describing it as if they're these it's funny, they kind of go back and forth between being external observers with academic detachment, and then they kind of zoom down in, okay, here's what the description of the system is like. But they don't really talk about, well, what's that process like? What's that acculturation process like? I mean, I can talk about some of that stuff as we go through the conversation, but I agree with you, Dimitri. It's kind of neither of those things. It's just an interesting approach. I mean, I don't think it's terrible. I think there's some limitations.
No, it's not terrible. It's interesting, but misleading, because you read on and you kind of, okay, so you're giving a theoretical background here and you're giving some contextual background there.
Right.
And then they just talk about one specific guy, intertwining that with some of their experience, which I think you can identify by the use of word nuke as opposed to nuclear in certain places.
Yes. So nuke is a cultural term in the Navy for somebody who's had nuclear power training and served on nuclear powered ships. And it's actually spelled N-U-K-E. So it's so it doesn't look like nuck, N-U-C. And that basically means, and sometimes it's not just a description of, oh, this person's had this training. It's also a description in the Navy of the way a person thinks. Starting from, you know, first principles, rational, very descriptive of the science and technology. And in fact, that's what I would occasionally get into trouble with my peers and confuse other people when I would talk about some of the social aspects of the situations that we were facing and normal accident theory and that kind of stuff, because that is not the way your average nuke talks or thinks. So it was difficult for people to get conceptually understand not so much what I was saying, because I could explain it, but why it was important. Why would anybody would care?
So Ralph, did you go through something like this as well in your training?
Oh, absolutely. And so I'll talk about some of the things that I think they left out and could have added. I mean, so one of the things we can talk about right now, they in the section on the submarine culture, they have some descriptions of the cult submariner culture and how it comes about. And they leave out a lot of the actual process. They describe it as almost like an assembly line, or here's what's intended, here's what happens. So they leave out a bunch of the fact that these kinds of things, many of these things aren't actually explained to people. You just do them. And you many times have to learn by process of trial and error, some of the culture aspects. So it's not often explained. I used to try very, very hard to explain it to my personnel why we do what we do, but there isn't a lot of effort expended on that. It's almost like, you know, riding a bicycle and just get on the bicycle and do what the other guy is doing. So let me give you some examples. So one of the things that they didn't emphasize that they really could have is this idea of we actually explicitly talk in the Navy about balancing centralization with decentralization. We just don't put it in that language. And what we talk about is that, you know, you're not allowed to deviate from procedures. You must follow the procedures as written. So there's that centralization aspect. And then they say, except all the manuals, even the, you know, the 10,000 page manuals, and we do have manuals that are that big, they're just broken up into different sections. they say that the designers say that there's no way they could have anticipated every single possible circumstance, particularly of a warship that would go into harm's way and could experience damage. And so at certain points, the procedures become a guide, and you have to decide how to apply them. They don't tell you how to make that decision. And of course, that's where all the challenge lies. And so what the Navy calls that's the idea of, like, does the procedure fit this way, or does this make sense, you know, given what I actually have going on? We call that questioning attitude, that you're not allowed to just, because what we tell people is we could get trained circus animals to follow a procedure verbatim without thinking, or you could have a robot do that. But that isn't what the Navy wants. The Navy wants people who are thinking and critically analyzing where they are and what's going on. And the name that we give for that, the sort of bumper sticker, is called questioning attitude. So that's this balancing between verbatim compliance and questioning attitude that they completely left out. And then they also, the other thing they left out, and it could have been just a feature of the time they were in the Navy, this respect for authority, right? So they do mention the respect for authority in there, but also the Navy cultivates what's called a watch team backup. And that would mean that if Pedro is the officer and I'm the enlisted man, or I'm his subordinate, and he gives me an order, and I don't think the order makes sense, I'm actually not supposed to just go follow the order. I'm supposed to go back to him and say, are you sure that's what you want me to do? Because here's this other information I have that you don't have. And it's actually, we censure leaders who are not open to that kind of feedback. I mean, you do get some people that get wrapped up in the whole authority thing. But a good example is when you talk about Chernobyl. So I don't want to go worst case here, but it is worth talking about briefly. I'm not saying Chernobyl, you know, couldn't happen in the U.S. Navy. I mean, there's design differences that make it, you know, less likely, but basically the operators completely disassembled and deconstructed all of their safety procedures so that they could go do the test in Chernobyl. And I used to tell people, and actually use this as a story for teaching the culture, I would say that couldn't happen in the U.S. Navy, because you'd get an operator would refuse to do that. And I've actually seen people refuse to carry out orders that they think don't make sense, or are going to put the propulsion plant or the systems in danger, and they don't get punished for it. I mean, you may have a sit down and talk about it with if they were wrong, if we find out later they were wrong, but you actually don't censure people for doing that. So that's something they left out of their description of the respect for authority. And then and I'll try not to make this too much longer, but there's a couple of things I think are pretty good here. They were talking about assessments and kind of evaluations and those kinds of things. Well, the new term for that, and I don't fault the authors for this, is transparency. And Dimitri, you were talking about that earlier, about external views and internal views and that kind of stuff. And so one of the things that we think is very important in higher liability organizations is embracing transparency, which means opening yourself up to audits, opening yourself up to criticism, you know, being willing to evaluate how you do things, and getting feedback from other people. And that's actually, if you're not open to that, that's a big problem and something that we take social action for. And something they also left out of the article that I think would have made it much better is they didn't even mention the fact, because when they were talking about, well, how did Rickover personally control all these things? And we can get into maybe some of that later. All the details are interesting. But what they left out of the article was, every commanding officer of every nuclear ship is required at the time they wrote this article, it was once a month, now it's once a quarter, is required to write a personal letter to the admiral. So back in the day, it was Admiral Rickover, about how your ship is functioning and what's going on and what you could do better and things you're having troubles with. And the admiral would personally read all these things and assign actions to his staff. And in fact, there's a code name for those actions that they still use in naval reactors today. The name isn't as important for the podcast, but they still refer to those actions from the admiral based on the letters that come from the ships as, you know, by that code name.
I love this so much, especially because it flies in the face of some of my prejudices about how military organizations are run. But one thing I want to ask you, Ralph, is that as you were saying that, it was in the back of my mind thinking, okay, so what you're saying here is that techno expertise can overthrow normal authority in a way, which is something that I'd never expect in the military context, especially, but not even in normal organizations, you know? So my question would be, does seniority usually follow technical? I mean, does seniority in the organization follows the technical seniority as well? So usually people are promoted based on how much knowledge they have of the technical aspects of running submarine or something like that?
Yes. So there's a combination. It's mixed in because there's military things you have to know, and then there's technical things you have to know. And we do find that some people don't balance that correctly. In the Navy, there's actually, for the enlisted, there are examinations you have to take for the first six ranks through the Navy. You have to take examinations to qualify for the next rank. And as a nuclear qualified officer, and I don't think these, back in the time when Beerley and Spender were junior officers, I don't think they had to do this. And now it's required of all the junior officers. You cannot continue on in the nuclear power community. You can continue in the Navy, you just can't continue as a nuke if you don't pass what's called the engineer's exam. And that it comes at the end of 2 years assignment or 3 years assignment for the submariners on your first ship. And it's a technical examination almost exclusively. And so you get a couple chances to pass it, but basically it's like doctoral qualifying exams where you have to know the design of the propulsion plant and the principles on which it's operated and the casual procedures and understand the basis for them. And it takes months of intense study to qualify for this exam. There's doctoral qualifiers, there's an oral component as well. So yes, that's very strongly a part of the program. And then later in your career, you go back for further schooling, and if you don't pass the technical requirements of that schooling, you don't continue on. So yes, it's intertwined with the community.
Well, you don't continue on, but you don't get dropped either, do you? You just stay where you are. It's not like management consulting situation.
Sorry, what?
So you have to sit these exams, and if you don't pass, you can still remain in the position where you are at the time of.
It depends. So in the case of enlisted, the answer is yes, because we need the skills so much. So yes, you can stay at that rank. In the case of officers, it actually doesn't affect your rank, but you cannot continue as a nuclear qualified officer. You must go seek other employment in the Navy. So you have to move to a different field. And there's people that do that. So in Beerley and Spender's day, it was optional to take the exam if you were leaving the Navy at the end of your first tour of duty as an officer. Now it's no longer optional. We require everybody who is even in for just one assignment, we require them to take that exam before they leave the Navy.
Okay. Is that clear for you, Dimitri? You have anything to say? Sorry.
Oh, yes. I think the only thing that I'd like to mention is that I think this is something that significantly sets the nuclear community apart from other branches of the military and probably majority of private organizations as well. Because this is then exclusively a high-skill, knowledge-intensive organization dealing with highly sophisticated, you know, tools of work.
Yeah, and what's particularly challenging, Beerley and Spender don't mention this, I don't think it attracts in the article, but what's particularly challenging in the nuclear power field is the intelligence level of the enlisted men is far above the average intelligence level or capability level of the rest of the Navy. And so you're, as an officer, you're leading people who are just as smart as you are and just chose not to go to college immediately. A lot of them go to college later, or they'll go to college while they're in the service. They get time to do that. And you have to use a different leadership style when you're teaching people who are just as smart as you are. And in fact, some of the enlisted people actually have master's degrees. They just chose not to become officers because they had, you know, other priorities. But I worked with several of the senior enlisted personnel and that have master's degrees. And for our listeners, when I say enlisted an officer, the prime distinction is in most militaries, an enlistment is you sign on for the military for a specified term of service. So it might be 4 years. In the case of nuclear power, it's 6 years because of the technical training that you get. And at the end of your term of service, if you don't actually sign another agreement, you can just walk out the door. And so you serve in terms, whereas as officers, when you get commissioned, you then continue your service as what we call in the United States the pleasure of the president, which means you must request to leave active duty and to either retire in my case or just leave, because the service might say, well, we have something a really important military operation going on and we can't afford to lose you, so you're going to stay a little bit longer. And that has happened in the past. It doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. So that's the primary distinction between officers and enlisted. So that may come up. People may wonder about that.
I just want to say something here, but I have to protest. I'm sorry, Ralph, but I feel a bit uncomfortable with when people say that, you know, oh, when you're dealing with people that are really smart, because I think that, you know, there are different ways to be smart and to be knowledgeable. So I think the point is more that, you know, you are highly trained, if anything, what you're trying to say.
Well, it all depends, right? So it depends on what you believe in, how much you believe in the concept of IQ and IQ tests and stuff. And so,
I really don't believe that.
Yeah. So, but it doesn't matter for this purpose. It doesn't matter what you and I believe. The Navy believes it, and they act like that. And so, their tests they give that they consider measures of or proxies for intelligence, and that's how these people score highly. I agree. That's highly debatable. Whether there is such a thing as intelligence that can be measured on a scale, and it does vary with what you know, but we don't need to go there. I'm just saying the Navy acts as if it is so, and so that's what I was talking about. And so the fundamental point of that is you're dealing with people who, so forget about whether it's an intelligent level. You know, they have a lot of understanding of the situation. So let me try to take the word intelligence out of it. You know, they're very aware, they're very perceptive, and they've got a very strong and active intellect. And therefore, they're more likely to question you and ask you, what are you doing? They're not likely to just march off like robots. And you have to factor that into the way you lead. So that's really what I was trying to talk. And I think we can leave intelligence out of that aspect. I'm sorry for being sloppy about that.
I'm going to push you further, and it turns upside down a bit.
That's good.
It's just that I feel that... And it's an important point, and I think it helps us to think of, you know, how does this relate to other organizations, is that you are dealing with people that are, okay, these people are dealing with very uncertain tasks, from what I understand, because, of course, the technology is so complex, and as you said, it can, like, it's how it behaves, the technology can never be completely predicted, so the person dealing with it must be given some kind of room to maneuver. And that creates a situation in which you cannot just expect people to follow everything by the book, because you know that would be actually at the end of the day compromise the very technology they're dealing with. So they have to have, you know, this space to act. So I think that you can construct the argument by coming from like the work that they are doing and how much autonomy they are given, because they feel that that's the best kind of design for the job. So then of course they have to adopt a new management style, which is less about full control and more about, you know, support and, you know, creating the conditions and being sure that people are on the same page and so on and so forth. That's, you know, capture the point without getting into much trouble on the hoids of intelligence.
Okay. And I think you summed it up quite well. So okay. I really have no, I completely agree with you on that then.
Okay. I'm going to expand a bit on that because it's something that you said that I want to go back, which is the whole idea of centralization and how you say that it's not discussed in that ways, but more about how you follow the procedures. Okay.
Okay.
My question there would be, so when you are faced with an unpredicted circumstance or somebody that's not in the manual, as you said, Does the person like in the front line, in a way, has the autonomy to just switch gears and do what they feel that's best for the situation? Is it usually something that has to be debated, or even if it's in a situation of, you know, stress or like time commitment with the superiors? You know, how is it? So at the end of the day, is the person really taking the decision that this has to be negotiated with the officer above him? You know, how does it work?
Well, that's a great question, and those circumstances come up not all the time, but frequently, and sometimes it relates to the hardware or electronics that are part of the system. Sometimes it relates to people processes and what motivates people and that sort of thing. And there are different styles. So some senior officers, once they have some of the problems reported to them, they will make the decision. They'll say, well, we should go do this, or, you know, go do that. I always felt that was undervaluing the autonomy and the empowerment I wanted to make sure the people I was working with had. So what I would tell them is, I'd say, when you encounter something like that, that's not by the book and you don't have the standard solution, come bring it to me, or, you know, bring it to us, more senior people, and talk about it. And we would try to create, it's hard to create specific rules and say, well, everything has to come to the senior officer, or only these certain things. But you actually tell people, that's actually part of the leadership practice you take. You say, here's the kind of things I want to know about, right? And they're pretty serious things. And then so everybody has these different thresholds, and that's part of what you have to teach people when you come to a new organization. And so what I try to do is, I would say, you know, when you bring this stuff to me, bring it to me in a structured way so we can have an effective conversation. So I would say, well, come tell me what the nature of the problem is. What does the book say? Why do you think the book doesn't apply? What you want to do, and why you want to do that, right? So I'm trying to understand, you know, what are they seeing? What are they thinking? You know, what are they, is there something that they're missing? And when we were having a conversation about what they wanted to do, one of the things I would always bring up is risks. I'd want to know, well, what have you analyzed the risks, and what do you think, and what might go in different directions? And that was actually, when I was working with people, they often found that surprising, because they would say, well, I'm just going to do the book, or I'm going to just do this. And I'd say, well, okay, but I want you to think through where the risks might be, and they might be in the hardware, they might be in the people, you know, people not understanding stuff. So I would always ask them, and we had this kind of built into the way we operate. They didn't actually put in the book, but they said, or in the paper, but it's actually, they refer to it very obliquely, and I don't remember where it is in there, but it's basically, you have to always understand and be able to predict the impact the action you're going to take is going to have on the physical systems of the propulsion plant. And so what that means is, okay, so you have not only have to predict it, you have to be able to then anticipate, well, what am I going to see? What data will I look for to tell me that this is a good or bad choice? Because you can get into all sorts of trouble in high reliability, or, you know, high risk situations, if you say, well, I'm going to just push this button and we'll just see what happens. That is not going to work out well for you. So that's the general nature of those conversations, how we would have them.
I think that helps us to bring home a lesson to general organizations, because centralization, decentralization is perhaps one of the fundamental thing about organizations. No? Organizations are just machines in which you split up and divide the work, and, you know, you let people do and accomplish a goal, but then you have to have some control where they're going. So it's a definition aspect of how organizations are run. And what seems that you are saying here, and it's very similar to what I saw in complex product development as well, is that there is almost like a modularization or a selection of what has to be centralized in a way or decentralized, because usually the debate is in general, complete centralization, complete decentralization. But what I hear that you're saying is that depending on the issues at hand, on depending of like how risky it might become, almost like if you have like in an ideal world, you could almost have a list of like what are the different themes that would expect, what are the situations, you know, it would bring. So it switches the conversation from full centralization, is it good or bad, for centralization of what is to be centralized, what is to be decentralized. So it's a more refined idea of how the system operates.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. And the key is, how do you manage it, right? It's one thing to say, because in the paper, the authors can really just talk about, well, it has to be balanced, or here's what you do. But I think the essence is, how do you go about managing it? And they don't, managing that balance. And they don't really talk about that in any of the, management or higher liability articles I've ever seen. And I'll give you an example. Is we had an ambiguity about an issue of instrumentation. So one of the operators was very concerned that we were going to execute a procedure, and his instrumentation would not effectively identify where the risks or problems were during that procedure. And so his immediate superiors talked to him, and then they said they wanted to come to me because I think he wasn't satisfied with their explanation. So it was not considered abnormal or strange. They just came to me and said, well, we want to talk about this. So we went through it, and I explained to him, my understanding of the procedure, why it was okay, what he was going to be able to do, and how we were going to balance the risk. But at the end of that statement, I said, now, if you're not satisfied with that, and you think I don't have it correct, I will pick up the phone, and I will call people in headquarters further up to talk about this, to get their perspective. I said, I believe I'm interpreting it correctly, and this is how this applies. And his response was, no, I'm satisfied. It's not that I've been heard and that we're going to manage it correctly, and therefore I'm not going to ask for that to be the case. But that's something that, not everybody will do, but I felt that was important for him to see, I'm willing to go take this up further in case you want. And I've done that other times. When I've had junior officers say, oh, we're making this huge mistake and we're doing this. And I'd say, and these were typically social things. And I'd say, well, here's how I understand how we're managing this social challenge. And if you want, I'll bring it up to one of my superiors in headquarters, and I'll let you know what he says. And the person would say, yeah, I'd like to know. And so I did that and would get back to him about it.
Okay. It's a very folded thing, if I understand correctly. Orchestration, this understanding of the situation, so both can understand what really makes sense in that sense. And I think it also connects with what's in the paper. Just go back to what we're discussing here. Is the whole idea that they say how in the submarine culture there is this idea of individualized commitment or individualized accountability, in which it goes along with empowerment, but it's a different way to put it. But it's not only about the role you are in, but how much commitment you have to that,
Yes.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, one of the things, you try not to take that commitment for granted. You actually have to build and nurture that commitment, at least from my perspective, you had to. So you could say, well, yeah, this person here, she's going to do it because they've joined the Navy and they're going to do this. I always felt like that was not appropriate to take for granted, that you had to continually earn their trust.
Mm-hmm. I have just a quick question, because I said before, referring to the submariners, him, is there any woman in this whole context?
It's yes.
Okay. Yes. So I wasn't correct.
We just changed. Yes. Well, when they wrote the article, it was true. But in the last 2 years, we've actually brought a small number of women onto attack submarines. So they're the biggest challenge because they're so confined. They have a pretty nice description in the article about how cramped it is and how you don't have enough beds in the submarines. We call it racks because they're very narrow beds or thin beds for the people and almost no privacy. I mean, for example, some of the enlisted compartments, they have room for, I think it's 12 people. And only maybe three can stand up in the room at the same time because the racks are that close together. And so you kind of have to time when you're going to get out of the bed. And then also if you're in one of these racks, they don't really describe this, but basically if your head's on the pillow and you're looking up at the rack above you, which is usually the case, then there are maybe 6 inches tops between your forehead and something above you. In fact, I woke up several times and banged my head into the light because the light actually extends down further, so you could read when you're in your rack or study or what have you. And I've got some scrapes on my forehead from bumping into the light fixture.
So you're essentially filed in there on the
shelf. So now we understand why do you use hats? It's to hide those things.
That's exactly right. I got some pretty bad scars on my forehead. Well, it's also because I spent you know, 30 years in the Navy, and I always had a hat on because it's required unless you're indoors. And they always have brims or bills, right? So it just drives me crazy when I'm outside and I'm getting the sun going right in my eyes. That's really hard for me.
Okay. So it's your way to continue, you know, the tradition. You know, like the queen, she cannot wear a crown every time. She just has a hat.
Yeah. There you go. That's right.
Love it.
And that's all for the first half of episode 11. Thank you for listening. Please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com for information on what to follow, future episodes, and for our blog. If you're enjoying this podcast, please make sure to tell your friends, colleagues, and students about us. If you go onto our website, under the podcast page, you can find a number of different options how you can help spread the word about us or get involved if you feel like doing so. Also, we're very keen to learn more about our listeners. So please do get in touch with us with any feedback and comments, and we'll probably be launching a listener survey soon, so please consider taking part in that as well. Thank you for joining, and I hope to see you next week as we continue our discussion of culture and high reliability here on Talking About Organizations.